The Evolve Network is now live at evolvenetwork.tv. Subscribe for meal plans, recipes, cooking shows, and our very own The Magic Pill and The Magic Plant, as well as access to my favourite documentaries. The Evolve Network is also home to our full library of podcasts, with new release podcasts airing first and in full on the channel. You can also watch selected vodcasts in a video format. Meanwhile, enjoy this highlight of our podcast and head over to evolvenetwork.tv for the full Evolve podcast experience. The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage at peteevans.com to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Richard, thank you so much for joining us on the chat today. How are you, brother?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Mate, really, really beautiful. Sun's coming up. It's a beautiful morning. And very grateful to be breathing some fresh air. That's for sure.
Well, it's 90-some degrees here and humid, so. But it's still good to be breathing fresh air.
Tell us a little bit about why you got involved in medicine and the health profession to start with. Shall we go down that path?
Oops. Why I got involved in medicine to begin with. I guess I couldn't think of anything better to do with my life to apply physics and actually help people. So the work that I was doing in physics had an awful lot to do with energy and control of energy systems. And that really looked to me like it was something that could be used by a lot of people for a lot of less than positive purposes. So I ended up directing myself into medicine, where I eventually found myself working with nuclear again. Some of the same materials, in fact. But, I think for me, the thing about medicine has been the honesty of the dean. When I walked into medical school, I remember the second thing that he told us was that 90% of what we would be taught was wrong. But nobody knew what that was. And for those of us who have research experience and the degrees and the training, to please apply ourselves. And I've spent decades doing that. In fact, if you count my pre-medicine career, because of the age in which I was recruited into the field, this is my 53rd year now of doing research.
I find it fascinating what's going on in the world at the moment about science. And I shared something the other day. It was a meme, basically, about people believing that science is now settled and we can't comment on it. And to do so is basically blasphemy. And let's just take COVID as an example of this. And, sure. You know, the alarm bells ring as soon as somebody says the science is settled. And I would love for your definition about science being settled and what you've discovered over your decades of being a researcher in this field.
Well, one of the nice things about science is I'm not sure it's ever settled. I would like to think we're getting a little smarter and a little bit more advanced. I mean, all of the work that I've done, if you've looked at my background, you know that in 1994, I developed the inflammation and cardiovascular disease theory, or inflammation and heart disease theory, or it's been given a number of names, but it was really the original theory that said that heart disease, coronary artery disease, is an inflammatory process. And I'd spent decades with American Heart training physicians and the general public about the role of cholesterol. And it plays a role. It clearly does. But it's not the only thing that plays a role. And so, you know, one of the interesting, the reason for pointing that out is I frequently will go to a conference and somebody will come up and say, well, you know, Dr. Fleming, that's not what you said 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And my first thought is, you need a better hobby rather than tracing around to see what I'm going to say. But and they'll go, well, that's not what you said 5 or 10 years ago. It's like, you know, what I said 5 or 10 years ago was based upon the knowledge base that we had. And as you pursue that, you start to uncover things and challenge things and investigate things and discover new things. And that changes then what you have to talk about. So I always tell students when they get, whether they're starting their PhD or their MD and they're interested in research, that the only challenging question you're going to have in science is your first one. Because once you do that project and you do it properly, you will find out that you have more questions now than you did before you started the topic. So, you know, really, I mean, that's one of the roles of being a scientist researcher, whether you're in medicine or physics or whatever, is the recognition that you're adding and building on, and you're building on to what other people have done. I mean, some of my work, you know, like I have a quadratic blood flow equation for coronary arteries that I developed. That's a proprietary equation. And the truth is that even though it's a quadratic function, there were these guys, you know, Pasui back in France in the 1700s, did it with rigid glass tubes. And he found out the blood flow was a property of a quadratic. Now, my equation's a little bit more sophisticated and it applies to human arteries. But, you know, here was this guy back, you know, no computers, rigid glass tubes, you know, doing it without, you know, air conditioning. So the fact that I was able to do anything is built upon what he did. And you know, absent, you know, any of that prerequisite knowledge, I wouldn't have built what I've done. And so all of it is a stepping stone, a building project. I have no problems with people asking questions of science. I frequently do. I mean, I review for somewhere around 17 or 18 medical journals. I'm constantly looking at the journal papers and I'm critiquing them. I mean, that's what I do. I ask questions. Is this valid? Is the question valid? Is the methodology valid? Is the analysis of the data valid? So that's my role as a reviewer and in a couple of journals as an editor. But, you know, the only challenge is, who's asking the questions? What are they asking the questions from? The basis of their knowledge for asking the questions, because, you know, as I look at social media, there's a lot of people asking questions that, frankly, just aren't good questions. And it shows a variety of things. It shows people that are just wanting to be noticed. It shows the misinformation that's out there and the confusion that's going on. It shows the desire of people in some instances to have a better understanding. I mean, you get all types of students when they're asking the questions. It's like in a classroom, you've got the person who just wants to get attention and you just have to go, you know, none of your questions, it's a Billy Madison moment. You know, I mean, nobody's better for having heard the question, and we're all dumber for having spent the time on it. But there are other students that will ask those questions that, you know, sometimes will even cause me to pause, and I'll go, Wow, that's a really good question. I mean, I may not be able to make you happy with my answer, but it makes me think or rethink something. So I don't think science is very subtle. I'm frustrated with the journals right now. I actually resigned from two journals last year, two prestigious journals, British Medical Journal and The Lancet, because I was convinced that what they were publishing was published not based upon science, but based upon agendas that weren't science. And the very last you need to hear from scientists and researchers and physicians are our opinions. You know, that's what you go to your mom and dad and get, you know, or your neighbor, or your best friend. You're sitting in a bar and you're listening to people's opinions. That's where you get opinions. You don't need my opinion. You need me to go, here's the facts. Here's what the research shows. SARS-CoV-2 is a classic example of a lot of misinformation and a lot of opinion and a lot of confusion as a result.
Yeah, it's interesting. And the mainstream media seems to be one big opinion piece now. It doesn't seem to operate in with science or facts anymore. And yeah. it's obvious because now I think the majority of the content that is contained in whether it's the New York Times or the Australian newspaper or whatever it is, it says opinion.
Right.
Like it's in your face now. Like they don't even try to hide it because they can't be sued for anything they say because it's an opinion. And I've had many articles written about me and they're all opinions. They're not based in fact. They're somebody's agenda to either discredit or ridicule or whatever it may be to play the game as they play it. So let's talk about SARS-CoV-2. And the question, what was your first question when this turned up into our reality? What was the question that should have been asked and the one that you wish had have been asked first and foremost?
Right. So I guess let me layer that with some information that's germane to understand where I would be coming from. So in 1994, when I came up with the inflammation theory that accounted first for heart disease and then cancer and diabetes and strokes and all these chronic inflammatory diseases, one of the things that I included in there were infectious diseases, bacteria and viruses, and because they play a role. And then part of what I've also done in trying to sort out why we misdiagnose or have poor analysis of things was I've developed a patented method to measure regional blood flow and metabolic tissue changes in the body. It's coupled with the fact that the nuclear images that are done are not calibrated quantitatively. They're qualitatively calibrated, which means they make pretty pictures over and over and over again. But the question is, what can you really tell from those pretty pictures? And that's dependent upon interpretation by whoever's reading the image. But it's not a measurable outcome. And in developing that patent, I discovered that the cameras have never been quantitatively calibrated to see if they're measuring properly. And that means that they may or may not be collecting all the data. And we've figured out that around a third of the data and many of the images is missing. So even what you're guessing at as a result is due to missing data. And we're very good at tweaking the cameras and everything and filling it in. But that doesn't really help patients. So, you know, part of it, what the patent FMTVDM does is it defines a quantitative calibration and then it lays out tissue from one end to the other of the spectrum, which means it's a measuring tool. And part of what we know is that you can find heart disease and cancers and inflammatory changes. So the first thing that came to mind was, you know, why aren't people differentiating what's going on with this virus? There's a difference between getting the virus, SARS-CoV-2, and a difference in you developing the disease, COVID-19. There's a difference between having high cholesterol and having coronary artery disease, okay? There's a difference between having an elevated blood sugar and having diabetes. So these are different. I mean, one is something that you can measure, and find, and the other one is an actual disease. And so what the theory said in 94, and then to bore you to death, it was repeated in 95 at American Heart. It was reduced to a textbook in 1999 in cardiology. And then between 2000 and 2003, I published a couple of papers with bacteria and treating them. And then in 2004, it was on 2020. So I would have thought kind of maybe somebody had heard of it. And then the ventilators, you know, there were three papers that were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, not by physicians, but by groups of physicians, committees responsible for ventilators. And all three papers showed that if you took somebody with this fluid accumulation in their lungs, like happens with SARS and COVID, which is called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS, and you give them the same amount of air each time the machine breathes for them, which is called the tidal volume, you will kill them. You have to cut it to half of that, because if you think about it, you have lungs that can be stretched and they're already inflamed from this disease, and you stretch them more, you're just going to irritate them more and cause more inflammation and blood clotting. And that's what they did. So, you know, it's not just my stuff that wasn't listened to. It was, you know, what these committees did on ventilators. So none of that got listened to, and everybody kind of went into a panic mode and got overwhelmed. So the first question was, why hasn't anybody been paying attention? You know, and part of that you could say, well, maybe that's me. You know, why didn't they pay attention to my theory, right? Okay. So I get that, except that everybody runs around and talks about inflammation and heart disease and say, we know about that theory. And it's like, well, if you knew about the theory, then you'd have been prepped for this. But you weren't prepped for this, so you really didn't read the theory. You just kept spouting the words. And that doesn't make you better at taking care of patients just because you can say the term, you know. It's one of the rules of medical students learn that just because you know a medical term doesn't mean you understand it. And, you know, the way that I was trained, we were very keen on using the terms so that patients had heard the terms and knew it. But then you had to be able to explain it to patients in terms that, you know, another language, like English, you know, the first language you learned that suggests that maybe you understand what you're talking about. So my first question is, why isn't anybody paying attention to the obvious? And then my second question was, why aren't we looking at treatments for the obvious? And then my third question was basically a statement, which is, okay, let's go look at what drugs work in different ways that would be applicable to viruses. So where everybody else was running, or not everybody, where a lot of people were running around and saying it's an anti-malarial or it's an antibiotic, my questions were, how do these things actually effectively treat parasites or bacteria? What's their mechanism of action? And so it took me several months to kind of, do a rapid gear up of what do we have out there? What do we know? And design a study to actually do a study to then sort out which drugs worked, which drugs could be measured by FMT-VDM to actually change the inflammation and thrombosis occurring in the body. And, you know, it wasn't a kind study. You had 72 hours to see an effect, because these drugs will have an effect within 72 hours if they're going to work. It's for your viewers. If you ever wonder why a physician prescribes a drug at a given, you know, three times a day or four times a day or once a day, it's based upon what's called the half-life of the drug. So it's the amount of time that it takes for half of the drug to be cleared out of your bloodstream. That's called the half-life. And a drug works, if you give a drug, you know if it's going to work after it's reached something called plasma steady state. CPSS, concentration plasma steady state. And plasma steady state is achieved after five half doses. So you look at the drugs that we use for SARS-CoV-2, and every one of them has a half-life of 12 hours or less. So five half-lives gives you 2.5 days. And so you don't mess around with it. If you have something that can kill somebody, you don't mess around with it. And that was a lesson that was drilled into me clinically by a Dr. Hankinson, who I don't know if he's even still alive, but he was an oncologist when I was an intern. And Dr. Hankinson was feared by a lot of the nurses and faculty because he was a no-nonsense physician. Something I think I probably am, which is, you know, I'm not in this to necessarily invite you over for Thanksgiving or Christmas. I'm here to take care of you and make a difference in whether you get sorted out and survive. So Hankinson was very big on the fact that if the oncology, the cancer patient came in and they had an infection, we cultured everything imaginable. And we started them, whether we liked it or not, on what's called a gram-positive and a gram-negative antibiotic coverage, which covers a lot of bacteria. And we had 36 to 48 hours to see an improvement. If not, we added another type of antibiotic, usually something called a macrolide antibiotic, to the regimen. And we had 36 to 48 hours to see improvement. If we didn't, we added on something called amphotericin, which was an antifungal. And we had that same 36 to 48 hours. And if they didn't improve, we added an antiviral. And by that time, you either saw improvement or a dead patient. I lost three patients that month, which was an all-time low, which doesn't make me feel any better because they were still three patients I took care of that died. Two of them had metastatic breast cancer, so it had spread all over their body. And the other one had he was 5 months into his diagnosis of metastatic pancreatic cancer, and the average lifespan 6 months. So, you know, I remind myself of that so I don't feel as terrible about those three patients dying as I actually do feel about those three patients dying. But it's a no-nonsense approach that says, look, there's really a science behind how this is done. Apply the science and do it to the benefit of the patient. So that's what I did not see being done in the United States or around the world. And that's what I set out to do. And when we did that, we discovered that 99.83% of the people responded to one of three regimens that we were able to sort out by doing this measurement. And in the outpatient setting, we saw very good outcomes, but with different combinations. And the one that always worked was a combination of primaquine, clindamycin, and hydroxychloroquine. I've heard a lot of criticisms about hydroxychloroquine. It's an aminoquinoline that can have an effect on heart rhythm disturbances. And yet, as a cardiologist, I've seen not a single paper published showing that a patient died from that heart rhythm disturbance because of hydroxychloroquine. So, you know, there's only two that we're talking about, and it won't mean much, but I'll say it slow enough so that your listeners can go Google it if they want to. But it's multiform ventricular tachydysrhythmia or torsade de poids. Those are the two rhythms that are life-threatening that occur when that area of the electrocardiogram that everybody's worried about with hydroxychloroquine stretches out and produces this abnormal rhythm. I've not seen a single one of the patients in our study. I've not heard anybody else doing studies comment that anybody died from this. I've not seen a single published paper showing this. I haven't even seen like a case example published. And you just know that if there were cases of this, they'd be publishing it to kind of prove their point. So it goes back to the concern and stress about science right now, because it's really a matter of who's controlling the science. What are the motives behind these people? Are they really trying to find answers, or are they trying to drive an agenda? And that's what worries me when I see it. But on the blunt side, you know, we're not selling shoes in medicine. You know, you get a bad pair of shoes, you go back, you trade them in, right? It's not comfortable. The ladies may not like it if you tell them they need a size bigger or that type of thing. And I can say that because I sold shoes when I was in high school. So I can say that. It was just one of those jobs that, you know, earned money as a kid. But if you botch up in medicine, people die. And, you know, we don't have this luxury of being more focused on an agenda than taking care of patients.
tell me about the combination of those three drugs that you mentioned that seem that have the 99.8%.
Right. So can we actually do screen share? Are you able to do that?
That's a good question. Let me just see if I can.
You see that?
We can.
Okay. So this is this these so if you're treating a virus, it doesn't matter whether it's a man-made virus like this one has been developed through gain of function or a naturally occurring one, you basically have to look at four things. You have to look at how this virus attaches itself to get into your cells. You have to look at how the virus replicates or reproduces itself. And then you have to look at the immune response to the virus. And the difference between having SARS-CoV-2, the infection, and COVID-19, the disease, is that most people respond with a well-balanced immune response and bring it under control. In 3 to 5 days, their T cells kick in and they release chemicals that are designed to kill cells that are infected and to kill the virus and to form blood clots to the area, which at first blush might not seem like a good idea until you realize that if you basically kill an invader and you block its blood supply so it can't get nutrients, you'll kill it. And then at about 7 to 10 days, the second part of our immune system, our adaptive humoral immune system, kicks in and the B cells or beta cells make antibodies to whatever is the infection, in this case, SARS-CoV-2. But that also produces this same phenomenon, and that blood clotting and inflammation, which I originally called and still call inflammothrombotic response, is the thing that's causing all the inflammation and blood clots in people. And it's been doing it in the people that have, quote, the comorbidities. You know, they're older, they're overweight or obese, they have heart disease or strokes or diabetes or cancer or one of the comorbidities, so that they are already hyper-inflammatory to begin with. That's their state of living because they have these diseases. So it takes very little more to perturb the system and cause this uncontrolled response. And so you have to address that. And so all the drugs that were included in the study looked at these different components, along with how do you get oxygen into the patient to begin with. So what you see here are successful mechanisms of actions of the drugs. And you were asking for like hydroxychloroquine was one of the ones you asked about. So if you look at hydroxychloroquine, it has more than one effect. Part of what it does is it inhibits the replication of the virus. It interferes with what's called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, which is how that RNA gets turned into a protein with the ribosomes. It, if you go down here, the next column, it interferes with the virus just simply attaching to the ACE2 receptor. And there's really four receptors that are involved. There's the ACE2 receptor. There is the TMPRSS2 receptor, which is a transmembrane protease serine 2. There is the furin cleavage site, which is why the PRRA insert is so critical. And there's neuropilin 1. So all four together work in conjunction to bring this virus into the cell. Well, hydroxychloroquine specifically interferes with the ACE2 receptor. It also enhances the ability of zinc to come in through a pore that zinc comes in through. So zinc is an ion. It's positively charged. So it comes in through an ionophore or an ion opening for zinc. And hydroxychloroquine helps that process. Hydroxychloroquine slightly increases the pH within something called the cytosols, which are if you will think, when the virus comes in, they get somewhat engulfed with these their cytosols, their membraned areas, and this interferes with this slight increase in pH interferes with the ability of the virus to unwrap itself, so that its genetic material can get into the cell to make more virus. If you go over to the next column, it interferes with what's called toll-like 7 receptors, which are the receptors in cells for single-stranded RNA viruses, which is what SARS-CoV-2 is. And when that's activated, this inflammation and blood clotting is activated. So it calms down that inflammation and blood clotting. It reduces other pro-inflammatory cytokines in from T cells. And that increase in cellular pH also plays a role on the expression of these broken down viral particles to the cell surface for T cells, which is called major histocompatibility.
I really hope you enjoyed the first half of this podcast. If you'd like to listen to the rest, please visit evolvenetwork.tv. That's evolvenetwork.tv. We'll see you there.
The information, views and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.